Hello and welcome to another episode of the Do More With Your Money podcast. This is episode 207. Today's session is a February question and answer session, questions which have been sent in by yourself, the viewer. And I'm surrounded by three fantastic guests, Oren Sampson, who is one of our compliance supervisors. And Oren, it's your first time on the podcast ever. I believe.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Chris Leland, a regular on the show, director of investment strategy, and also Hayley Mack, client service and supervisor. And Hayley, you've been on quite a few times now, haven't you?
Quite a few times, yeah.
So welcome to you all. It's also, I believe, the first podcast where we've had a Liverpool and an Everton fan sitting opposite each other. So hopefully no fights.
We'll try not to.
But like I said before, this is a Q&A session. So we're going to go through some questions, what the viewer has sent in, or you, the viewer, sent in. So thank you for sending, and hopefully we'll be able to give you some really good answers on the show today. So I'm going to go straight to Oren. Client has sent in, as I get nearer retirement, say 15 to 10 years to go, should I de-risk? And if so, when?
Well, de-risking is when you adjust the risk rating of your pension or your funds to protect from stock market falls. Yeah. However, on the other side of the coin, when you de-risk, you're also reducing the potential for your fund to go up as well. Mm-hmm. So 10 to 15 years, what I would tend to say there is for de-risking, that would tend to be sort of like a long time to de-risk. The reason why is over the last, since the FT 100 index started off around about 1983, I don't think the stock market has dropped over a 10-year period since then. So it's unlikely that that's going to happen going forward.
Yeah.
Also, that's put together with the fact that we don't just invest in the stock market. There's also other asset classes such as property, bonds, as such. I would usually tend to look at around about 5 to 10 years when looking at de-risking, and it would depend on what the client's circumstances are.
Yeah.
If they've got a set time for retirement, if they know they're definitely going to retire at that date, if they need a guaranteed income.
Yeah.
I would tend to say that what a client is best off doing is speaking to their financial advisor, making sure that they give all the information to the financial advisor, such as what the current situation is, assets, liabilities, most importantly, what they want to do for the future. The advisor will then probably give them advice on de-risking, and that's probably going to be round about 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, 10 to 15 to 10 years or 10 to 15 years is probably a long time.
That's right.
And also as well, Oren, I suppose, circumstances change, what you said.
Exactly,
And I think a lot of pensions, which were set up quite a few years ago, be it a works pension or be it a personal pension, everybody had different retirement ages.
That's correct,
And then retirement ages might not be their retirement age anymore. You know, you could have said, I want to retire at 55.
Exactly.
And now you want to retire at 60 or you want to retire at 65.
Yeah.
So it's really important, I would say, that you get regularly reviewed by your financial advisor. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Especially recently, since pension freedoms has come along, where you can choose the type of income that you take from your retirement. It could be sort of a cap drawdown, flexible access drawdown, or alternatively, you can purchase an annuity, depending on what your circumstances are. Yeah. But if you're getting the regular reviews, keeping in contact with your financial advisor, they're going to be able to give you advice that's aimed at what the client's particular circumstances are and what they want to achieve.
Yeah. And I suppose that's a really good point, what you've said, is that not only have people's potentially, well, their retirement ages changed, but also pension freedoms have brought in a lot of different changes. So you could have a lot more flexibility in your pension, a lot more, you know, they're not as static or as rigid as what pensions, what they used to be. So
that's,
it's really important. You can flexibly access them as well.
Exactly.
And I suppose a really good point, what Oren said, Chris, was they don't just invest in equities. The portfolios, if you have a look at the True Potential portfolios, they're invested in a wide range of assets. And obviously that is going to obviously have some, you know, interest towards the client de-risking because they're in a managed portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if we look at the portfolios that we have five different risk categories, and within there, each portfolio has a different mix of assets overall, but every single portfolio is what we call multi-asset. And the reason why we do that is because you'll have some assets that do well at certain points in the market cycle, but then others that maybe won't. But then that will turn around at other points overall. So I think for us, it's really important to have a mixture of different assets that work at different points. And that for us allows for what I describe as probably a much smoother journey for the client overall.
Yeah. Okay, good. So not taking as much risk as what you would be in the stock market 100%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah, great. Okay. So let's have a look at a different question. Let's say I wanted to transfer my pension into True Potential. Hayley, how long does it take to transfer a pension? And is there anything that the client needs to know from a time point of view?
So it usually takes about 3 weeks to transfer it over. We can do it all through the technology that we use, so through the client sites and on their app online. It's a really straightforward process, to be honest with you. They just need to tell us the details of that particular pension or ISA or general investment account that they're transferring over. And we will pretty much take care of the rest. We will update them, kind of track it along the way, send them updates as and when the money lands with us once it's been transferred over. Yeah, so pretty much the policy number, provider, value, and then everything else is taken care of by us.
And if the client's really confident with the technology, with the app, they don't just have the to ring you. They could do it via the app themselves. Is that correct?
Yeah. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So they can either call us and we can like call browse and help them through it that way if they've never done it before, or if they want a little bit of a hand with it, or they can just log on themselves and do it.
Okay, great. So fairly simple to do.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
What about time-wise? How long does it normally take, the average transfer time? Is that about?
About 3 weeks.
3 weeks,
For the funds to have been sort of disinvested with the previous provider, moved over to us and then reinvested about 3 weeks.
Great. So a fairly simple process.
Yeah.
Speaking of pensions, speaking of funds, question from one of our viewers. Any plans to introduce any new funds into the into True Potential portfolios in 2024?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. So when we think around the current lineup that we have of of different managers, we're really happy with that lineup overall. And remember, what is it that we want? We want different managers that work at different points in the cycle, different specialisms, bringing all of that together within one single portfolio. Now, once you start to get a certain number of managers, it then becomes much harder to get a manager that is different to those managers, as you can expect. So I think from my perspective, we speak to, I say roughly around about 35, 40 different product providers over the year to say, look, is there something that you could bring that is different to what we have right now? Again, I think that's a little bit harder currently. But I think the other thing that we look at as well is, can you actually bring something similar but better? So what I mean by that, is there another manager that is doing something very similar to one of the managers that we work with, but actually doing it in a better way? So we're constantly looking at the peer group to try and understand, is there a manager that is offering that? Right now, we don't think there is, but what we'll do is we'll keep looking on that as we move through 2024. So to kind of answer your question fairly directly, there's definitively nothing right now that we are potentially going to be launching, but we'll see what happens as we move through the kind of back end of this year.
Yeah. And it's not that long since we've had sort of Pictet on board, to be quite fair, is it?
Yeah, exactly. So we launched five funds with Pictet, which would have been early 2022. We launched an income fund with Waverton, same time, and an income fund with UBS as well.
Yeah. So been relatively new additions already into the portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, completely right.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So I know it's January. I know it's the start of the new year. And, you know, we've all, maybe some of us have had to do self-assessments because we've got that January deadline, but it'll not be too long before tax year end approaches. So I'm going to probably throw the next question to Hayley and to Oren. When I come to tax year, I've got the deadline, whatever it is, if it's my ISA or my pension, but then I've got a day after and it's the new tax year. So should I put my money in my ISA or my pension? So I'll probably throw this first one to you, Oren.
Yeah.
What's the tax benefits of an ISA and a pension.
Yeah. Well, should you put your money in an ISA or a pension? Well, the correct answer is it depends. I will expand on that a little bit, though. What happens is your ISA, your individual savings account, it's our true potential investment ISAs recommended for investments medium term, which means 5 years plus. For ISAs, if you are saving or you've got an objective over the medium term and you are looking for a lump sum and you want to save tax efficiently and also get the benefits of potential stock market growth, an ISA would probably be the way to go. However, with pensions, I'm not going to go into the pros and cons because I know that Hayley's going to be talking a little bit more about that. But with pensions, if you're looking to retire and save for an income at age 55 or at retirement age, then it's probably better that you put money into a pension if you're looking to save for retirement or an income for the rest of your life. There's pros and cons such as tax relief with pensions and tax efficient growth with ISAs. But do you want to go through a couple of the pros and cons of...
Yeah, so I think just mirroring what you said, to be honest with you. So I think the way in which people look at the different products as depending on what they're saving for. So ISAs, I think, are generally looked at as more of a short-term, like quick save investment, whereas pensions are a longer term. With your pensions, you can then kind of look at it for your retirement. It's then moving into like the beneficiary side of things.
Yes.
So if you want to set up like an expression of wish on that account for kind of moving forwards and thinking of even kind of further on past your retirement and what that's going to do for like family, whoever it is that you've got that. I think it just really depends on the personal circumstance of the particular client, to be honest with you, as to which one to go into. Always recommend speaking to your financial advisor. They'll be able to kind of guide you and tell you which way is the best thing to do for yourself. And then from that, you can make that decision. What's also good is you don't have to just have one or the other. You can have both.
That's true.
You can have a couple of different goals. One could be a holiday that you're saving up for, a house purchase, whatever it might be. But then you can also have your pension running alongside and looking for you.
That's a good point. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, if you're talking about maybe the cons of each one would be probably the limitations in which you can top up.
Absolutely.
The ISA being 20,000 and also the pensions being 60 or 100% of your relevant earnings.
That's true,
And what about the tax? You get tax in a pension. You get tax put into your pension, obviously, from the government every time you make a contribution.
I can expand on that a bit. You receive tax relief on personal pensions. If you're a basic rate taxpayer, you can get up to sort of like 20%.
Yeah.
And then if you're a high rate taxpayer, you can then reclaim your high rate from the HMRC.
Yeah.
What that basically means is, say, for instance, you're contributing £240 per month into a pension and you're a basic rate taxpayer. Another 20% or £60 will be added once we reclaim it from HMRC, which and that will be added to your pension. So that's a major advantage for putting money into your pension. Also, when you come to receive your pension, you'd get up to 25% as a tax-free cash lump sum that you can take directly from your pension. Obviously, any income that you take after that would be taxed at your normal tax rate.
And a lot of questions we get in, a lot of comments as well, you know, an ISA is, if you take money out of your ISA, it's income tax-free and capital gains tax-free. But lot of people say, well, you get tax put into your pension, but when you take the money, you get taxed out. But I suppose if you're saving over a 20, 25-year term, it's going to be growth on that money that you're getting from the government as well.
That's right.
So that's going to benefit you.
Exactly so,
Okay, great. So, Hayley, more on your side, you deal with a lot of client inquiries with you and your team. Topping up every tax year end, and we get a lot of topping up every tax year end, especially in May. Just tell us the process of how clients can top up their pensions, you know, from a technology point of view or from a customer care point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. So they can just log in to their client site. They can do it through their app and online. We have a technology that we use called ImpulseSave. It's a really, really straightforward process. And for anyone topping up last minute, which I know a lot of people like to leave it to the kind of really last minute, that goes in as like a bank transfer, basically straight into your pension or your ISA. The way I describe it to clients when I'm speaking about it is like it's like an Amazon purchase. So you can click into your app, you pop your card details in, you remember it for next time, it's ready to go. You can set a specific amount, you can close your gap, you can use your remaining allowance, which will all be detailed on the page for you as well. And then we can do it that way. So that's just like a one-off lump sum payment in. You can also set up a direct debit. So people who go into the new tax year, they start setting goals and kind of putting plans in place for looking to fulfill their allowances for the tax year coming up. They set up direct debits at the start of that time frame, and then that's set up for the next sort of however long they want it to run. Yeah. So regular income, regular payments straight into the pensions or ISAs, and then again with the impulse saves.
And it's really important to say there's an easy way through tech. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't sure on tax, you could always speak to an advisor.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we can book you in for that.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So interest rates are coming down. How do you think mortgage rates are going to be affected? Chris, I'll pass that over to you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if we look in the UK right now, we look at kind of market pricing as at this morning, the expectation is that they'll be between 4 to 5 0.25% cuts this year. We think that is quite a lot. Now, if we think about what's happening with mortgage pricing, this is quite pertinent to me because I'm actually repricing my mortgage in the next couple of days. So I had a 2-year fixed mortgage. I think that was on just over 1%. That's obviously going to move up fairly significantly. But what I would say is not as significantly as what we've seen before. Yeah. You know, you see mortgage rates, I think at one point we're just over 6. Mm. I think they're coming down to just below 4 now. You know, it's still means that people like myself will have to pay more money, unfortunately. But what I would say is it's maybe not as bad as what we were seeing kind of late last year, and certainly maybe not as bad as some of the media stories that have been banded around overall.
So by the end of this year, 2024, what is it probably, you know, predicted to be around?
Yeah, around 4%.
Around 4%.
Yeah, okay. just over 4%.
And I think a lot of people who are renewing their mortgages or the mortgage rate who are due will probably be thinking, do I sign up for a 2-year? Do I sign up for a 3-year? I suppose that's the question really, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if we think of the direction of travel of where could interest rates get to, I'm going to put myself on the line here a little bit by saying this, but
please do.
I personally think it's unlikely that we interest rates go right the way down to kind of 0.5% that we saw previously. What could cause that? A more negative scenario, actually, a more recessionary scenario, whereby you see the Bank of England cut rates very, very quickly. That's not our base case. But what I do see is interest rates, you know, certainly coming down from here. I'm not going to put a figure on it, though.
I suppose we've had it from an interest rate point of view, though, over the past 10 years, we've had it good for quite a few years.
Yeah. I think it's a really good point. It's almost like, you know, is the last kind of 10 years been the abnormality, and now we're in what is a maybe more normal interest rate environment. I'd say that interest rates to me are quite high at the moment, so they will come down. But again, I doubt you're gonna see them come down unless something more negative happens. You're not gonna see them come right the way down to near zero.
Okay, good point. So staying with you, Chris.
Yes.
We've got the increasing US debt bubble at this moment. And it may cause an issue leading up to the US elections. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. I was looking at some stats this morning. So the US has $34 trillion of outstanding debt. So the way that a lot of people look at that is you look at debt as a percentage of GDP to try and get an idea of how that has changed. So the figure right now is 120%. To put that into context, in the 1980s, that figure would have been around about 35% overall. Obviously, the more debt you have, the more you need to pay to service that debt. Because obviously, you've got to pay the coupon payments on US Treasuries. And I think, you know, if we look at the issuance calendar for US debt over the next 3 to 4 months, you're seeing quite significant issuance coming through overall. But just around the election question, it's a good question. Actually, it's something that we've been discussing ourselves. Because there isn't so much money around to use, I think it makes it a lot more difficult for a potential candidate to promise the world. So you think of the UK, think of Liz Truss. You know, she came in, she said, right, you know, we're going to spend all this money. Then what happened is you saw sterling collapse, you saw gilt yields massively spike up, you saw all that pain in markets. And it's because everyone was saying, well, you know, how are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for all this spending? So I think what it'll mean is that each candidate in the US will have to be quite considered around how they think what's most important for them to spend money on, but what's most important for their voters. So you can't say, right, I'm going to spend money on absolutely everything because there's no money there to do. So you've got to be quite considered around that overall.
And maybe just look at the UK announcement that time, Liz Truss is a bad example of what not to do.
I mean, you know, the big thing about Liz Truss is she didn't say how she was going to pay for it. So I'm not going to say, you know, maybe what she came up with could have been the right thing to do. But, you know, it's a bit like saying, oh, I'm going to go and buy a new car. And then someone says, well, you know, how are you going to pay for it? And you're like, so you're not going to go and buy a new car, then, are you?
It's like when we go for a pint, Chris, and you never buy them.
That's exactly it.
I forgot my wallet. I've been there plenty of times. Okay. So we're going to go back to pensions. If you're already taking your retirement benefits, so if you're in drawdown, which means accessing your pension fund, can you add money to your pension, even if you're retired or you're taking an income from it?
Well, the answer to that, Neil, is yes. However, there are a few caveats to that. We've got a money purchase annual allowance, which is currently £10,000. So what that means is, if you're taking an income from a pension, you're restricted to a maximum of up to £10,000 put into your pension. However, the MPA or Money Purchase Annual Allowance, that doesn't come in until you're taking an income. So say, for instance, you've got a drawdown and you just withdraw your 25%.
Your tax-free cash.
What you can then do is you can put as much as you like up to your taxable earnings. I think the maximum is £60,000 into per year into a pension. So your MPA wouldn't come into force. Also, if you are taking a lifetime annuity, that prevents any restriction with Money Purchase Annual Allowance. So in a nutshell, you can put up to £10,000 into your pension in any circumstances. However, there's some circumstances where you can put more in. Again, you're probably best off speaking to your financial advisor who can then look at your circumstances, see what you want, and then provide advice from
there. But basically, say you get to retirement, I want to pay off my mortgage. I'm going to use some of my tax-free cash, but I don't want to touch the rest of the pot. Now I want to come in some money. I want to put some more money in. You've still got that big allowance of £60,000.
That's great.
Or you're 100% of your earnings. But as soon as you start taking an income from that pension, then you're limited to the £10,000.
That's exactly right.
But if you're not sure, as again, you know, just speak to one of the financial advisors at True Potential, and we'll gladly look at your income, your expenditure, and how much money you want to have a look at. Well, thanks. Thanks for that, Oren. Okay, so back to you, Chris. Do the True Potential portfolios hold more equity investments or bonds, and which are less volatile?
Yeah, sure. It's a good question. So It really, I'm going to answer it in the same way that Aaron answered it, which is depends.
Yeah.
So that's a typical for management answer. So within that, it depends on which risk category that you're in. So we have five risk categories: defensive, cautious, balanced, growth, and aggressive. As you can imagine, aggressive is the highest risk. I was going to say the most aggressive, but the highest risk. Defensive is the lowest risk overall. So I've got some figures here. So aggressive would be around about 92% in equity. It's got around about 2.5% in bonds. And then defensive, you've got around about 33% in bonds, and you've got around about 24% in equity overall. So what you tend to find is that defensive and cautious have a little bit more within bonds versus equities. But then when you move to balance, growth, and aggressive, you've got a bigger equity part overall. Just from a volatility perspective, so we use forecast volatility from Morningstar. So to give you some figures, US equities are 4 times more volatile compared to UK gilt, so UK government debt overall. Just around kind of, you know, how we think around equities and bonds and the kind of definition there, if you want me to cover that. You know, if you buy an equity, you own the equity, you're a part owner of the company. Whereas a bond is a company needs to raise finance. So you invest in the bond, they pay you a coupon payment, and then you get your money back at the end. So if the company goes bust, the bondholders have priority over the equity holders overall. But to really long answer your question, to summarize, basically equities tend over the longer term to be normally more volatile than bonds. There's been some points over the last year or so that switch around, but normally you'd expect equity volatility to be high.
So the higher risk you go, the more equities or shares there in that portfolio. And the less risk that you take, there tends to be more of the safer stuff or the more guaranteed returns like bonds, fixed interest securities.
That's exactly it. So basically what it is, you know, if you're willing to take higher risk, you've got the potential for a higher return overall, but you've also got to be willing to stomach that higher level of volatility.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. So from a risk point of view, and I know that we assess clients on an annual basis.
That's correct,
it's always good to, maybe if you're coming up to a retirement, we're talking about, you know, at the start of the call, we're talking about de-risking. It's really good to have that annual review. The true potential annual suitability review reviews your risk.
That's correct.
So it's a good opportunity for us to know if it's changed. And there is actually an online risk assessment. So it'll tell us whether or not your risk has changed by going through various questions. But what I would say is, obviously, from a review point of view, it's really important to have your annual suitability review and complete that because you've got that option to think, where am I now risk-wise and can I get it changed, which is really important. Good. So speaking about customer care. Speaking about client contact. If I want to speak to a true potential financial advisor, we obviously have them working from head office and many of them. How do I actually book an appointment with one of those true potential advisors?
Yeah, of course. So you can either call up the team and we will arrange the appointment for you. You can send in a message via your client site. You can send us an email. You can go on live chat. You can book an appointment directly through the app or the client site. So there's a few different ways to get in touch, to be fair. We've got different methods of kind of phone calls and communication that we can have with the advisors as well. So this is all detailed on the appointment time and slot that you're booking. You can schedule just a phone call, which is absolutely fine. But the most popular is a video call. I think with advisors, they tend to be longer appointments. So you're looking kind of at least half an hour, if not a bit longer. I think for clients, yes, we are very kind of driven in technology and we do a lot of things on the app. But for the client to be able to see who they're speaking to, they see
really
the face of the advisor. It's just things like facial expressions and body language. And you it just puts a little kind of real personal touch on the particular appointment.
We try to book a video call as much as possible because
we do.
We find it really works from breaking down those sort of initial barriers.
It does. So we would always offer, if we were ever speak to clients on the phone, we would always offer the video call first and then it would be either turned down and booked as a phone call. But clients are really receptive of it, to be fair.
And it's really important point what you said, Hayley, is you may not want to speak to an advisor for an hour because you might not be taking income from your pension. You might just think, well, I've got a quick tax question I need to ask one of them.
Absolutely.
And also, I've got a busy life. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. 20 minutes call, we can book that in.
Yeah, exactly.
And the really important thing is what we've just launched, which is the diary system via via the mobile app.
It is, yes.
Where clients can log into their mobile and just organise a slot straight away and get confirmation back, which is really, really good.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So many ways to book an appointment.
Many ways.
If you like the old-fashioned way of ringing us up, we can do that straight away.
Absolutely.
Or if you're more tech-savvy, get on your app and book it in. Really, really good. So final question today. Got a question about inheritance tax. I'm going to pass it over to you, Warren. What are the rules regarding inheritance tax? Just sort of like the top-end rules and the basics when considering it.
Yeah. Inheritance tax is potentially paid if an estate is valued over $325,000. There's some caveats to that. You can actually pass funds on to a civil partner or a charity or a spouse, and that would be totally free from inheritance tax. There is a few other caveats where if your estate contains a property, you can actually, your threshold will increase to 500,000.
And that's per person, isn't it, Oren?
That is per person,
So typically, if you probably had a married couple, they would have £325,000 cover each.
That's correct,
But if you have a residential property, which you're thinking of passing on, that could be lifted up to £1 million for a couple.
Yeah, 500 each. Yeah, that's great. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's also other ways where you can mitigate your inheritance tax, such as you can gift. So you can gift to grandchildren, children, a certain amount each year. You can actually gift to strangers £250 per month. So if you wanted to gift me £250 a month, Neil, you're free to do that without any problems from HMRC.
I'll just get my debit card after the podcast,
There's other ways you can gift as well. So you can gift for a wedding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's other aspects. And there's also other things that you can do, such as pass your property on to son, daughter, grandchild. Here's a few in-depth issues that you need to cover. However, if you were to speak to one of our financial advisors, what they'd do is they'd look at your situation, look at your income and outgoings, assets, liabilities, work out what your inheritance tax potential is, and then provide advice from there.
Yeah, so basically give you advice if you weren't sure on what size your estate is.
Speak
to one of our financial advisors.
Yeah,
they will take into consideration maybe your house valuation and that sort of stuff. But we talked on previous podcasts about pensions being outside of your estate.
That's correct.
That doesn't have to be considered, does it?
No. Anything contained in a pension, so any assets you've got in a pension, will be outside of your estate for the reasons of inheritance tax. So that's why, that's one of the other pros of putting money into a pension. It keeps money outside of your estate. So if you do have to pay inheritance tax on death, anything in your pension wouldn't be considered.
Yeah, great. Good point. And I think as well, we've had it on previous podcasts where people want to take out the tax-free cash out of their pension because they think they have to, but they've got no reason to. But by not taking the whole of the tax-free cash and keeping it in the pension, it actually lowers the amount of the estate because it's still in that pension wrapper, isn't it?
That's true. Bit of advice is if you don't need to take money out of your tax-free cash, it's best off leaving it where it is. Reason why is it's growing tax-free. There's no tax on it. It becomes, it's outside your estate for inheritance tax reasons. And it's just easier leaving your funds in your pension unless you need to use it for any reason.
Great point. Great point. Okay. Thanks, Oren. So, I think that's it for the Q&As today. Thank you, everybody, for participating. Thank you, everybody, for viewing today. Please like and subscribe. And we hope to see you in the next podcast. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.